I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We know it as Proud Mary, but the popular hit tune was inspired by Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Music creativity can come from anywhere. Today we'll learn the stories and evolution of songs that define generations. Mark Myers, the author of a new book that uncovers the roots of some of the most iconic music in rock, R&B, and blues, will bring us the creation tales of Proud Mary, Heart of Glass, and K.C. Loving. Compositions can take weeks or be finished in 10 minutes. They're written on trains, in exotic locations, as a solitary exercise, or as a collaboration. It's all part of the anatomy of a song. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The idea seemed to come out of nowhere, write about songs the way some people write about people. The thinking was that there would be great stories behind some of our iconic songs, just as there are great stories behind interesting people. Writer Mark Myers, a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal, got the assignment to write about those songs, and that's led to his Anatomy of a Song column in the paper, and a new book, Anatomy of a Song, the oral history of 45 iconic hits that changed rock, R&B, and pop. Mark is also the man behind the jazzwax.com music blog. And folks, check it out because it's become a must-read for me every day. It provides such a fascinating perspective on music, musicians, and great songs. I have so much appreciation for what Mark puts into that blog each day and the work he puts into it. This is Mark's second visit to Up to Date. And Mark, what a pleasure to have you again. Welcome.
Steve, thank you so much for having me.
Where does your love of music come from, Mark?
I guess isolation. When I was a kid, my folks moved out of the city north of New York to middle of Westchester County, northern Westchester County, and I just didn't fit in. So music became, I guess, my best friend.
Did you ever think it would lead you to conversations with folks like Mick Jagger and Debbie Harry and Merle Haggard?
Never in my wildest dreams, but to be honest, I'm waiting my whole life to do this.
Tell us about the story of the phone call that got you started on the Anatomy of a Song column, because this came right out of the blue.
I was having lunch in New York, actually with my wife, and I got a text from the desk at the Wall Street Journal, and they wanted to try something new. They wanted to try what they were calling Anatomy of a Song, which was, let's focus on one song, let's talk to the songwriter, and just do a whole number on that one particular song. And I said, well, which song do you want to start with? And I got back, why don't we start with My Girl by Smokey Robinson?
You know, that's a heck of an idea from an editor who oftentimes don't have great ideas, Mark, as we all know who toil in the trenches here.
No, it's totally true. Initially, they were looking for a write-through, which in the business means you write the story and add some quotes from, in this case, Smokey Robinson. And we did that, and I did that, and that worked out fine. And then the second one we did sort of the same way. But by the third one, I started to realize that it wasn't fitting in its natural groove, that for this column to really take off as a narrative, it needed to be an oral history. The reader needed to read the words of the artist directly, not through what I was interpreting.
Well, I really like your new book. And I'm wondering, did you pick the songs in the book because, you know, the songs were significant themselves, or because the song had a great backstory behind it?
No, the songs I chose because, number one, they were personal. I grew up with them. Not all of them, obviously. Some predate me and some come after my interest in that genre. So it's more about these songs, I guess, Steve, are what I would call the cool cousins of the mainstream songs. They're not the interstate highway hits that you would expect from these artists. Mm-hmm. They're a bit off the beaten path. So, you know, with Mick Jagger, not Jumpin' Jack Flash, but Moonlight Mile, mm-hmm. right? Not mm-hmm. Born to be Wild by Steppenwolf, but Magic Carpet Ride. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of off the beaten trail a little bit, and that garnered a great story.
You know, you've talked to Jagger and Joni Mitchell and so many of the other great songwriters. I'm wondering, how articulate they are about the process of writing these songs, because oftentimes the process is so personal, and it strikes me as often so elusive as well.
Their enthusiasm is fascinating, because once they realize that all I care about is art, I'm not interested in the junk, not interested in the tabloid stuff, but once they realize I was there for the art, they in turn delivered poetry. And what they talked about, it was as if they were talking about their favorite child. It wasn't even as if they were talking about a song anymore. It was deeply personal, and they were showing off their favorite kid.
You know, it struck me, too, just spinning through the book, that there's so much luck involved in this songwriting process, too, in the process of making a hit. You know, someone remembers a song that was written years ago. It didn't go very far. And suddenly they revisit it and turn it into this smash number one sensation. How much luck is involved here?
Not so much luck, because the talent is there.
Of course.
And then you've got great producers in the studio very often who have visions for what they want to do, and they have an understanding of what a hit will be, what they have to do to make it a hit. So that's a big help. But, you know, I think if there's a common thread in some of these songs, it's the pressure of deadline. A lot of these songs were written at the last minute, or because the original version didn't work out and they didn't have much time left and they had to figure out a better way to do it. And, you know, whether it's Walk This Way, where they, you know, go down to Times Square to see Young Frankenstein come back and love that line, Walk This Way, and that becomes the title of the song. Or Time After Time, which Cyndi Lauper found in a TV guide in the studio with not much time to go to get that song done.
She found what in a TV guide? The words?
The title. Time After Time. They were stuck. When she went into the studio with Rob Hyman, her co-writer, they wanted to start with titles, because most artists do. They start with a title, and that sort of gets them juiced to create the lyrics. And when they're in there, they can't quite come up with a title that they both like. It's just not happening. And Cyndi picks up a TV guide, and she starts looking through the titles and finds a science fiction film from 1979. And, you know, she decides, let's start with this title. This sounds like it's going to be fine. But she never expected it to be the title of the song. It was just a starting point. Funny, huh?
How big of a hit was this for her?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, this was a major hit. This went to number four, I believe. And it was just, I mean, it identified her. It still identifies her. It's sort of this sad, happy ballad of leaving, whether it's a lover or a town, a small town. And the video, of course, Steve, really kicked in the visual.
You know, this is apropos of nothing, but a few months ago, you put up a link to Miles Davis's one of his versions of that song, which just absolutely stopped me. This song that we're listening to right now, it just stopped me. Just absolutely incredible. I'd never heard it before.
Wasn't that something?
Yeah.
And, you know, we can thank Cicely Tyson, Miles Davis's wife at the time, for that.
That's right.
The album. She's so unusual, and insisted he listen to it. And she insisted he listen to Time After Time, and he recorded it.
How about a different song here, Mark? The Rolling Stones and Street Fighting Man. You say the sound of French police car sirens got the Stones and Mick Jagger thinking in a different way about this song.
Keith was extremely, you know, this is, when we were talking, I asked what was the big influence on the melody, and he laughed and he said French police sirens, which of course, as anybody knows, goes
Yeah, right.
And if you listen to the song, You hear that very reference in the middle of the song.
That's really and what else did they say about this particular song and how they put it together?
What most people don't know about this song, which blew my mind when Keith told me, is that it's all acoustic except for the electric bass. In other words, Keith is basically putting down that power chord in the beginning on his knees, and he's putting it into a very small early cassette recorder. He couldn't use an electric guitar because it overwhelmed the tiny little mic, so he used the acoustic guitar. And Charlie Watts is playing this 1930s little drum kit that drummers would take on the train and put on their lap to practice. And there he is, you know, it's all acoustic. And then Keith stood up and played the electric bass because Bill Wyman wasn't there. And that's the only electric instrument on here is the electric bass. But if you listen to this song, you'll hear exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, was it harder to make great songs years ago, Mark, before all this high-tech equipment came along? Because, again, I don't know anything about this stuff, but I would guess that the answer to that is yes.
Songwriting, Steve, used to be like building furniture. There was one person who wrote the song, words and music, or it was two people. And I mean, if you go to, it's not better or worse today, it's just different. So, because things have changed. Technology has changed, the listeners' ears have changed, even music has changed. So, if you go to the Billboard Top 10, for example, and start to look at the credits, you notice there's like 8-9 people on each of the songs for the top 10. And that has a variety of, you know, reasons for that. But ultimately, you know, what you have today is when I was a kid, you used to sit down and stare at speakers when you listened to music.
Yeah.
You know, you'd look at the album and stare at the speakers and listen.
Yeah.
And today, it's mostly background.
Yes.
Kids have it, you know, behind them while they work on their computers or at the gym.
Well, you used to sit and look at the album over it for hours, trying to glean some sort of meaning out of the damn thing that may or may not was ever there to begin with, you know?
Yeah, the cover, the notes, who produced it. It's funny, right?
You talk about some of the other tricks that were used in some of these songs, Mark. How about The Doors and Light My Fire? What did they do with that song to make it what it was?
Well, I mean, there's a number of things. First of all, you know, why that song is infectious to begin with, it's sort of catchy and you kind of love the main theme area of it. And I asked the drummer, John Densmore, why is it so addictive? And I said, there's almost like a Latin beat in there.
Yes.
And John said, you know, true confession, I was actually a fan of Girl from Ipanema. I loved Stan Getz and Astrid Gilberto's hit in 1964. And I used a bossa nova beat in there.
Now, that is so interesting because you do hear that. It's got that easygoing something behind it, despite the Morrison vocal, which is so obviously powerful, you know. But there's that background thing that is a little bit easier, isn't it?
Yeah, he's using his stick and he's, you know, he's got it laying on the snare and he's striking it against the rim, almost like a lounge bossa nova player.
Let's listen to a little bit of The Doors and Light My Fire. You know, you say, Mark, that you don't know if a song is going to turn out to be iconic for as long as 25 years after it was released. Why so many years? I mean, why can't we know right away?
You know, to me, when I was putting this together, I said, I really owe the reader an explanation of what the word iconic means, how I'm defining it.
Yeah.
And iconic means over time. So is that 20 minutes? Is it 2 years? Is it 6 years? And what I figured is it really needs a generation. It needed 25 years, which is why I stopped in 1991 with REM's Losing My Religion, because it needs 25 years to burn off the fad, burn off the trends, burn off the times in which it was recorded. I mean, if we go back 25 years and we say, oh, at the time, you know, let's say the early 80s, whatever 25 years is, but if we insist that, you know, culture clubs, you know, one of Culture Club's hits is the absolute be-all, end-all, and it's going to be the greatest song ever recorded. We might feel that way at the time because it seems like that. But 25 years later, it's a good song. Is it iconic? Probably not.
That's interesting. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with Mark Myers, his new book, Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. Mark, I've heard you talk about this idea that why are some hit songs iconic while others simply fade away? I mean, what is it about some of the songs that causes them to hang around? After you've spent so much time studying them for your book, have you come to a conclusion here?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, Steve. To me, I mean, you know, I'm extremely passionate about this music, and I look at it as art. I look at it, you know, on the same level as any other art. And for a song to be iconic for me, there's an invisible frequency, right? So there's a frequency between the artist who created it. If it's a great song and it really stands the test of time and still moves people today, there's this invisible beam that runs between the artist's heart and the listener.
Oh,
and it doesn't matter the age, but there's a connection, there's a bond. So if you hear Magic Carpet Ride today, or you hear Groovin', if you just put on Groovin' for a kid today,
yeah,
that kid's going to hear the Young Rascals' emotion. They're going to hear, you know, Felix Cavalieri's feelings about the woman he was writing about. They hear it invisibly, and they respond to it. That, to me, is an iconic song.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, another thing I was wondering here, you talk to these artists about topics they've been asked about over and over and over again over the years. How did you get them to talk about it? How did you get the interviews to begin with?
Well, you know, some of these interviews were done on the phone. Some of them were done in person. The ones, you know, that were done are always, I need to do two things, Steve. I need to set up to 6-7 hours of research because I need to know more about this music than they do. I need to know everything about it. I need to know the full anatomy of these songs. And then what I need to do is I need to push the town limit, the city limits, beyond what everybody already knows. So once I know everything that's been written about these songs, I then owe it to the reader to go beyond that and provide little bits of detail and insights that haven't really been captured yet.
And I bet the folks you're interviewing recognize that and appreciate it pretty quickly, Mark.
Well, that's what's interesting, because sometimes, for instance, on Moonlight Mile, I got a great story on loneliness out of Mick Jagger.
I wanted to ask you about that, because that story in the book is so interesting to me.
It's harrowing, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I felt as though I was sitting with him next to him on that train, feeling that depression. And I had 20 minutes with Mick Jagger, 21, 22 minutes. That was it. So to answer your question, I need to be so well-versed in what they do. But most important, they need to be able to feel my passion. Because in order for me to get a great story out of them, I need to be able to go down to Passionsville with them. I need to talk in their language, which is the passion and the art and the poetry of their music. Once they understand where I'm at, once they understand I'm not there for scandal and I'm not there for tabloid dirt, they then treat me like a serious investigator, and they are much more open very, very quickly, because speed is of the essence. I need to get that story as fast as possible, but I can't rush it to the point where they realize or think that I'm putting time and my interests above what they're trying to tell me.
Oh, that's interesting. I was so interested in Jagger's story about what spurred him to write Moonlight Mile. Tell us about that.
You know, when we did Moonlight Mile, It was an interesting song because it's a curious song. You don't quite know where it's coming from and why it's even on Sticky Fingers. But when Mick starts talking about it, and he's talking about the loneliness of touring in 1972, you know, you have to keep in mind there's no real security back then, not like we have today. There's no staging. There's no protection against fans throwing things. And they're feeling a great deal of hostility when they're traveling on the British, on the European continent in 72, I think it is. And they're alone all the time. They have to travel a lot of times by night on trains because they can't get hotels, or the management is too cheap, or they don't have the money. They haven't been paid yet. So he's just staring out the window, you know, in the moonlight. He's watching very late at night, at midnight. He's watching the moon play off the countryside as this train is whizzing through the dark, heading to the next concert engagement. But talking to him about it, I could really feel the depths of his loneliness. Mm-hmm. And what I do in these songs, as you know, is I try to capture the artist's voice so that the reader, the biggest compliment I can get is the reader telling me, I felt like Mick was talking to me. I didn't even feel that you were there. I felt we were having that conversation.
That's great. You know, if you go to jazzwax.com, along the right-hand side, there's a rail of all the musicians and other folks, for that matter, that you've interviewed over the years for the Wall Street Journal and your other assignments. Here's a question for you. New York Times does this occasionally. You've interviewed all these famous folks. If you could invite four musicians that you've interviewed over the years to dinner, they could be living or dead, who would you want to sit down with again and have spend an evening with, Mark?
Wow, that's a toughie.
Yeah, I figured it might be.
You know, living or dead, I mean, gosh, that's
the folks you talk to. Yeah.
Yeah, let's say, you know, Sonny Rollins. Love to have Sonny Rollins
really?
There.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Sonny Rollins is so mystical. I mean, he's so yes. fascinating. He's had so much history. He is the history of individualism. I mean, when you think about jazz and personal expression
yep.
and changing how the saxophone sounds, how the tenor saxophone's personality sounds, it's Sonny Rollins, right, in the early 1950s. I would probably want to have Jerry Lee Lewis there. I would probably want to have Keith Richards there.
Yeah.
And I would probably want to have Joni Mitchell there.
sounds pretty good. Listen, if you can arrange it, invite me and I'll bring the Joe's Barbecue, okay?
Arthur Bryant's.
Arthur Bryant's. I'm flexible. I can go there, too. Let's do this, Mark. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with Mark Myers. We're going to turn to some other iconic songs like Kansas City, Proud Mary, and Heart of Glass, and run through some different versions of the different tracks and talk about them, and Mark will break them down for us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, the ethics professors discussed the most pressing moral questions from recent news. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday, how to civilize politics. Is it too late? Also, we'll look at the history of disaster management by the president and how disasters have changed over the past two centuries. And we're visiting this hour with Mark Myers. He's a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal. His new book, Anatomy of a Song, The Oral Histories of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. And Mark, just for the record, our theme music is by Bobby Watson, who teaches here at UMKC, you know, great jazz artist.
Fabulous.
And,
it's fabulous,
I just love his stuff and love what he's done for our show. Well, let's turn to some of these iconic songs that you talk, three of them that you talk about in the book. And one that means a whole lot to this town is the song Kansas City. I didn't realize that it was originally titled KC Loving. Why was it called that?
Well, it's also one of Lieber and Stoller's first very early productions. This is 1952. Los Angeles is just crowded with R&B recording and artists at this point in time. Mike Stoller and Jerry Lieber are both in Los Angeles, and they begin to see that they can get a lot of work helping produce and write songs for these artists and this R&B industry that's rising up. And they create this song called Kansas City that they call Kansas City. But when they take it into Federal, the label, Federal Records, the head of Federal says, Kansas City, that's square, man. He says, you know, this has to be hip. Let's call it KC Loving. And it got changed that way, much to Mike's chagrin. Mike was not happy about that change, but they were too young to really make a fuss. They had no real power to do it. And, of course, the song never even charts, so maybe too hip by half.
I was going to say, the song doesn't chart. It fades away pretty quickly, but then a few years later, it's revived. How did that happen?
Wilbert Harrison had been playing this song for years. He had heard Little Willie's version for years, and he gave it his own feel, which, you know, when you listen to it, has sort of a stroll. It has a different sound. It's not as bluesy, and it's more of a stroll. And people started, you know, the stroll was popular then, and that the dance, and people started to really feel what he was doing with it. And it just was it was the right song at the right time. And as Mike said, you know, KC Loving fell off the charts, but then we had a hit with it 7 years later.
We're going to listen to Wilbert Harrison's version in just a few minutes. You know, he changed a key line in the song, which you point out in the book, Mark, from "They've got a crazy way of loving there, and I'm going to get me some," to "They got some crazy little women there, and I'm going to get me one." That was a change that people here appreciate a whole lot, Mark, because it's a line that everyone knows.
Yeah, I think it was a little too risque originally. It was for a little bit of a different market. And I think, you know, instead of making it somebody going off to Kansas City for a variety of things, they narrowed it to one thing.
One more thing about this song that so interested me. A whole batch of singles of this song were issued one after another in 1959. And again, we're going to listen to some of them here. Hank Ballard, Little Richard. Why did that happen?
Because Wilbert Harrison had a monster hit with this thing. It was number one. And when something's number one, every producer wants a version of it. Little Richards, of course, you know, he sort of stuck to the original a little bit, but then he recorded the entire second side as Hey, Hey, Hey. He completely changed it, which is sort of a violation. You're never supposed to change the lyrics of an original song. You can interpret it, but to change the lyrics, you know, creates a major legal problem. But for Lieber and Stoller, as Mike told me, what are they going to do? You know, Little Richard's the father of rock and roll. You know, what are you going to do? So they let him share on his version in the royalties because of, you know, who he was and what he was bringing to that song. And, of course, the Beatles pick it up. They do Little Richard's version. And, you know, they don't even realize that it's Lieber and Stoller. Lieber and Stoller have to go around correcting everybody and making it clear that this didn't come out of thin air. It came from them.
Well, let's do this. Let's listen to the original version by Wilbert Harris, and then we'll listen to some other tracks as well.
Well, I might take the train, I might take the plane, but if I have to walk, I'm going just the same. Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. They got some crazy little women there, and I'm gonna get me one. Ah, but you know, yeah, myself.
Okay, let's do this now, Mark, if we can. Let's go back and listen to what the Beatles did to this song. This was 5 years later in 1964. This is the Beatles playing their version of Kansas City. Is that Paul singing the lead there?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And you say they had no idea what the song, the history of the song, or really what it represented.
Right. I mean, Paul is basically lifting Little Richard's version. There's no concept of the history beyond that.
Let's go to Little Richard's version and take a listen to this one then. So Little Richard's, he's messing with this song a little bit, isn't he?
He's messing with it quite a bit. He's bringing soul to it, and he's bringing a very heavy R&B feel, New Orleans style.
Yeah, okay. Let's go to one more version here, or maybe a couple more. This is Hank Ballard's version, another one that came out in 1959. There's nothing about 12th Street and Vine that really resembles anything the way it was back in the day any longer. But interesting.
And
anything
Hank
about
Ballard
Hank?
Version,
yeah.
Yeah, the Hank Ballard version is almost two ticks too slow, right?
Yes.
You kind of want it to be a little more, you want a little more pickup there, but it feels as though it's almost lumbering.
But the point is that song was flexible. People could do a lot
yeah,
of things
exactly.
with it. Well, let's go to a different song here. Let's go to Proud Mary that John Fogerty wrote for Creedence Clearwater Revival. I love how these songs get started because Fogerty told you that he kept a small notebook and kept a list of song title ideas in it. His first entry that he'd ever wrote down was Proud Mary, and he didn't even know what those words meant. He just liked how they sounded together. It's a pretty interesting story, Mark.
There's no context to that at all. He just liked the way they sounded, just as you said, Steve. He's waiting for his Army discharge papers. He's in the Army Reserve. In 1967, he gets them in the mail. When he goes down to the mailbox, he flips out. He does a handstand outside, jumps up, runs upstairs to his apartment, grabs his Rickenbacker guitar, and starts fooling around with something he had been playing with for an introduction. He was playing around with Beethoven's Fifth, the opening, dun 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 dun, and
yeah.
he doesn't quite like what Beethoven did with it. Doesn't really care for it, and instead of putting the emphasis on the fourth, dun 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 dun, he puts the emphasis on the first chord, dun 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 dun. I mean, you can hear that intro. It's Beethoven's Fifth with the emphasis on the first chord, not the fourth.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of the Creedence Clearwater Revival version of Proud Mary. Here we go.
Waking for the man every night and day, and I never lost a minute.
But the original Proud Mary that we're listening to here was almost solely a John Fogerty creation, you write. But the band had a huge fight over it. What happened there?
For whatever reason, John Fogerty wanted the vocals to be a certain way, the background vocals. And what he got, for some reason, was a sort of a garagey sound. It wasn't as clean as he wanted it. He wanted something very specific. So when they all went off to dinner, John went back to the studio and he overdubbed the vocals. He did all the vocal background vocals in harmony by overdubbing his own voice. And they had a fit. I mean, they just really had a fit about it.
And the band almost broke up over it, right?
They did. But as soon as he said, calm down, let me play it back for you. And when he played it back, everything was quiet. And then one of the musicians said, oh, wow.
That works.
Yeah.
That's the genius of John Fogerty then.
Oh, unbelievable. He is so amazingly talented.
He had never even seen the Mississippi River when he wrote that song, but before the song came out, he made a point of going to see it, right? What did he do?
He saw a movie in which two riverboats race, and this notion that a riverboat had a personality, that Proud Mary could feel something and express something and have a personality and have a point of view in the river as it travels and trudges up the river. That's what he was aiming for. But of course, what's fascinating is he goes down, you know, to Memphis at one point, and little kids take him to see a riverboat that's dry docked. And he looked at the boat and he said, "That's exactly how I envisioned Proud Mary."
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, Isn't that poetic?
That's great. That's just let's listen to three other versions of Proud Mary. The first one is from Solomon Burke. What should we know about this one, Mark?
This is really important because you can't understand Ike and Tina Turner's version unless you listen to Solomon Burke's version and you listen to the Checkmates Limited. Now, on Solomon Burke, listen to what he does in the beginning part. It's narration. He's not singing but telling you a story. Go ahead.
Might have missed that little intro there, but he speaks basically.
What he does in the beginning, exactly, he talks. He's just talking about Proud Mary and why it's a special, you know, he talks through, there's a good minute, 30-second narration by Solomon Burke there. And the song only goes to number 45.
Now we have the version from Sonny Charles, also from 1969. What about this one?
This is the Checkmates Limited, and now you're going to hear an extremely upbeat, raucous version of this song.
Okay, and now those two versions give birth to something that Ike and Tina Turner did in 1970, just a year later, and this is a version that a lot of folks are still going to remember.
Steve, they basically take the two versions and put them together like a sandwich.
Here we go. Let's listen to Ike and Tina Turner. This is their version of Proud Mary. You know, Mark, you couldn't play that song any faster and get away with it, I think.
Exactly right. And that song goes to number four. And that's a huge hit in 1971.
They
basically took the narration, you know, what she says, we're going to start nice and easy, but we never do anything easy. We're going to do it nice and rough. That's always her starter on that. And that's what they did. They sandwiched it.
All right. If you're just joining us again, you're listening to Up to Date. We're having a great time with writer Mark Myers from The Wall Street Journal, going through his book, some of the iconic hits that he writes about in Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. Let's go now to Heart of Glass, a completely different type of song that Blondie made famous. It was released back in 1979. This was a mashup of punk and disco, as you write. And this song is something of a miracle that it was ever created. It sits around for years, and then it gets a magical rebirth. What happened to Heart of Glass, Mark?
Well, in 74, Chris Stein of Blondie's on his couch fooling around, and he just loves Rock the Boat by the Hughes Corporation, the disco song. And he's fooling around with it, and, you know, he's overdubbing and doing some stuff with his little home studio. And he comes up with something, and Debbie Harry adds some lyrics to it. And they play it at clubs like Max's Kansas City and CBGB, and the fans like it, you know, and they call it the disco song. That's what they, you know, play the disco song, play the disco song. So they play it in the clubs. And finally, Blondie, they call it Once I Had a Love, and they kind of just shelve it away. And by 1978, their label, they want a hit album. It's time. Either it's make or break time. They're either going to have a hit, or they got to get rid of Blondie. So the label hires Michael Chapman, the English producer,
right,
to work this thing out. And Chapman asks Debbie Harry, says, "Who's your favorite singer?" And Debbie says, "Donna Summer." And Chapman says, "Whoa, I never didn't even hear that coming." And he creates this whole Giorgio Moroder Euro disco Kraftwerk sound behind them in the analog age, before the digital age. And if you listen to Debbie Harry on this song, those those are, sorry for the bad voice, but, you know, to illustrate, but that's Donna Summer on I Feel Love.
Well, let's do this. Let's listen to Blondie's original version of this song, the disco song, and then we'll move on to Donna Summer's version and the hit that Blondie made famous here. Here's Blondie with the disco song from 1975. Okay, now let's move to the song that inspired Debbie Harry so much.
Just a quick jump in, Steve.
Yes,
that
please.
Was the reggae. That's the reggae demo.
Okay.
Which also had different lyrics, as you probably noticed.
Let's go to Donna Summer, the woman who inspired Deborah Harry so much. This is her version of I Feel Love from 1977. So Deborah Harry's listening to that thinking, this works for me, right?
She loves Donna Summer.
Okay. Well, let's go to the version then of Heart of Glass that became the big hit. This is Blondie performing Heart of Glass. It was released in 1979. You know, it still sounds good. That phrase, Heart of Glass, where did that come from?
They came up with that because the original lyric, as you probably heard in the demo, was a little bit different and a little bit risque, and they didn't think that they would have a hit if they used the original lyric.
Okay.
That he was a pain in the blank.
I think I get it. Okay.
Yes. Rhymes with glass.
Yeah. Let's go to one more song that a lot of folks love, Midnight Train to Georgia. Tell us about this story, about this song and how it came to be, Mark.
So in 1970, songwriter Jim Weatherly, he dials up his friend Lee Majors. He needs to talk to him about his flag football team. They were both flag football players. But Majors isn't home. His girlfriend Farrah Fawcett answers the phone, and she tells him, look, Lee is out, and I've got to catch a midnight plane to Houston. I got to go. So Weatherly hangs up. He goes, midnight plane to Houston. Midnight plane to Houston. That's pretty good. That's pretty good for a song. So he writes a song called Midnight Plane to Houston. He records it, and then his manager sends it out to higher-profile people who hopefully will cover it and make him lots of money. And, you know, Weatherly, the first person who picks it up is Sissy Houston. Sissy looks at the title, and she says, Midnight Plane to Houston. She says, my family comes from Georgia, and nobody down there flies on a plane. So she goes back to Weatherly and says, do you mind if I change the title to Midnight Train to Georgia? And he says, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Why not?
So she, yeah. And then Gladys covers, Sissy doesn't have, it doesn't really chart, but Gladys picks it up. She wants to do it. And then, of course, she brings it.
Well, let's listen to the first track here, Jim Weatherly's original version, Plane to Houston.
And she's leaving on the midnight plane to Houston, going back to a simpler place and time. I'll be with her.
Okay, now let's walk along the evolution of this song. This is Sissy Houston now. She's changed the words, as Mark just explained, to Train to Georgia. This is from 1972.
So he's pawned all his hopes, and he even sold his old car. What a one-way ticket back to the life he once knew.
Now, let's go to Gladys Knight. She takes this song one step further, and this is the hit that most people are going to recognize here. This is from 1973, Train to Georgia.
I'm always leaving on that midnight train to Georgia. Yeah, said he's going back.
Well, that's about a clear of an evolution of a song as you're going to see, right?
Isn't that great?
That's just very, very interesting to see how that tracked along.
I'm sorry, Steve.
Well, I was going to say, I want to ask you, but in just the minute or so we have left here, about your blog again, is jazzwax.com. Again, I'm a huge fan. How do you put that thing together each day, and where do you get your ideas for it? Because you're doing it 6 days a week, Mark.
A lot of times, Steve, it's what I was listening to that day while I was writing.
There you go.
How do you decide that? Well, you know, it's mood. It's the weather. It's how cold it is or how warm it is. You know, sometimes if it's hot out, you know, a lot of times in the summer, I'll listen to the Beach Boys, a lot of pop. I'll listen to a lot of reggae. Sometimes, you know, in the wintertime, it'll be more jazz. So, you know, it's a mood thing. And then, like today, what I did is I created what I call a YouTube cocktail. I found drone footage of Vermont foliage, and I matched that. I muted that and then brought up the sound of Sarah Vaughan singing Moonlight in Vermont. So you can watch the drone footage and then listen to Sarah Vaughan. It's an interesting cocktail juxtaposition.
You got to be thinking about the blog all the time, because you're going from one idea one day to a completely different thing the next day, at least most days, and you're thinking about it a lot, right?
I schedule what I'm going to do, but I write that between about 6:30 and 8:30. I really hold it to that. because I've got so much going on. I'm just phenomenally busy. So, you know, between the book and the Wall Street Journal columns that I write and the other Wall Street Journal work that I do, the blog fits right into that slot. But it fits in that slot because I know what I'm going to write that day.
Well, it's nice work. You've made a great life for yourself.
Thank you,
Mark.
Steve.
And again, I can't recommend to our listeners enough to check out jazzwax.com. And you also want to look at Mark Meyer's new book, Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. And Mark, next time you're in town, please call. I'd love to get together.
I love being with you today, Steve.
Mark, thanks so much. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On Monday, an American Public Square discussion on how to bring civility back to politics. Also, we learn how well U.S. presidents have handled disaster management. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from KCUR's Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.